Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What comes to mind when a 125-year-old company that used to have its name on the tallest building in America announces it's closing 120 stores? How about, where did Sears go wrong? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson in for Kai Rizdahl. You're listening to the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 27th of December. In all your holiday shopping this year, did you go to Sears? I'm guessing the answer is no. The company announced today that because of weak holiday sales, it is going to close 120 Sears and Kmart stores. So what went wrong? We asked Sally Herships to find out.
To understand the problem with Sears and Kmart, you need to think about the competition. George Whalen is a retail consultant. He says Walmart and Target have made major changes in the past 5 years.
They're better laid out. They got better lighting, better signage. They're just a better shopping environment.
But Sears is stuck. Whalen says the brand has done some silly things, like not spending money to improve its stores.
You just have to do that in this kind of environment. If you don't, you get left behind.
Instead, Sears and Kmart used extra cash to buy stock, their own. Bert Flickinger is a retail consultant. He says the decision was made by the store's owner, ESL Investments, a hedge fund.
The Wall Street people missed the detail of retail.
By buying its own stock, Flickinger says ESL hoped to create a shortage and drive up stock prices for current owners. Great, but what does that have to do with shoppers?
Shoppers don't want to see a higher stock price. Shoppers want to see a lower shelf price.
There is one area that Sears still excels at.
Sears is the largest single seller of appliances in the United States.
Paul Swinand is a retail analyst with Morningstar.
Their appliance business is one of the few businesses that is not copied by Target, Walmart, JCPenney. So those stores do not sell appliances.
But there aren't as many new homeowners these days, so there's less demand for big ticket items like washing machines. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Well, as Sally just said, there isn't exactly a mad dash right now to buy homes, so this news is probably not a surprise. Home prices fell in October in 19 of the 20 American cities surveyed in the S&P Case-Shiller Index. That makes 6 months in a row that the overall index has gone down, and it's just the latest indication that 2011 was probably not the year the housing market turned itself around. Marketplace's Eve Troeh reports.
Cast your mind back to the beginning of this year. Remember the housing market predictions? Me neither. I asked Richard Peterson at Market Psych Data to take us back.
People were feeling like things were turning up because rates were low and because the equity markets were improving.
Were improving. Political standoffs in the U.S. and a debt crisis in Europe injected uncertainty. That made banks stingy. People who were ready to buy a house this year couldn't get a loan.
Lending standards have tightened now to 20% down, plus good credit scores, and individuals are having to prove income over many, many years.
Banks should be cautious after a bust as scary as the one we saw a few years ago, says Chris Thornburg at Beacon Economics. And he says falling prices are good. People don't have to borrow as much.
Housing is not an investment. Housing is a consumption good. And on that basis, the cheaper the house, the better off we are as a society. You know, if gas prices are going down, we're all happy about that.
Yet many prospective buyers are still waiting for that elusive bottom of the market. If prices are still falling, why buy now? Economist Peter Morici at the University of Maryland says more homes would sell now if employment and wages improved.
If people had more incomes to buy homes, the housing market would bottom out.
Steady paychecks would let more people snap up good real estate deals. But for now, rentals are on the rise, and builders are framing up more new apartments to meet demand in 2012. I'm Eve Troeh for Marketplace.
Light bulb manufacturers have just a few days left of making those good old-fashioned incandescent bulbs. This Sunday, they'll stop manufacturing some of the bulbs in favor of more energy-efficient ones. Now, for most appliances that use light bulbs, the switch won't be a big deal because the new bulbs will still give off light. What they won't give off is enough heat to warm up, say, an easy-bake oven. That little change is already causing problems in the household of Marketplace's Scott Tong.
pour one and a half.
On Christmas, 8-year-old Audrey Tong got the Easy Bake Oven she requested, but Santa left out the heating element, a 100-watt light bulb, which we didn't have, nor did any stores open Sunday. So we improvised with a 75.
We have to bake it a little bit longer.
20. Or 18 or 16.
What's wrong with 100 water anyway? Lighting industry consultant Craig DeLuey.
It's really a glorified heater. You know, only about 10 to 15% of its electrical input is actually produced as light. The rest is mostly heat.
That's why President Bush signed a law to phase out the least efficient incandescents. It's been a light bulb war ever since. Just last week, congressional Republicans deprived the government money to enforce the law. Industry? Not happy. They invested for a high-tech future. Joseph Higby speaks for the National Electrical Manufacturers Association.
A delay in enforcement undermines those investments and creates regulatory uncertainty.
Back in the Tong kitchen, we pull out the Easy Bake Cake.
Oh, what do we got here? Oh, not done. Okay, put it back in. Put it back in. 2 more minutes.
Doughy. Hasbro does make a newer oven with no light bulb required. Santa just didn't deliver that one. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Here's a headline you probably haven't heard in a while. Music sales are up this year. Only by 1%, according to Nielsen SoundScan, but up nonetheless. The leaders of this new song-buying trend?
She ain't real. She ain't gonna be.
British neo-soul singer Adele's album 21 and...
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas.
Michael Bublé's album called Christmas. Two very different styles. So, what to make of it? We asked music industry analyst Philip Lee.
Musical tastes are highly individualistic. That's typical of what makes the industry tick.
And Lee says the good times are here to stay for the music industry, thanks in part to all those iPhones and Androids.
More and more people are buying digital tracks because they have smartphones.
So, he says, as sales of smartphones go up, so too will the sales of digital music. As for Bublé, he's pretty happy about it.
And I'm feeling good.
Wall Street wasn't feeling much of anything today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers.
Feeling good. Fish in the sea. You know how I feel. River running free. You know how I feel.
So, economically speaking, let's say 2008 was the year of the crash. 2009 was the year we hit bottom. 2010 was the year we got angry. And 2011 was the year we rose up. From the streets of Cairo to the streets of Athens to the streets of New York, people demanded accountability. Marketplace's David Brancaccio has been covering all of it as part of his Economy 4.0 series, which explores how the new economy can better serve more people. And he joins us now from New York. Hi, David.
Hello, Jeremy.
Well, it's been a year of moments all across the world, from the street vendor in Tunisia who sparked the revolution there, to the huge protests in Tahrir Square in Cairo, Egypt, to Zuccotti Park, right where you are in New York City. Is there a moment for you that has stood out as you've covered this year of the rise of the people?
The first one probably comes from, of all people, a big-time CEO. Sir Martin Sorrell was speaking at the World Economic Forum, that gathering of the great and the good in Davos, Switzerland. Sorrell's the head of WPP. It's the biggest advertising company on the planet. And he's speaking in late January. There's a lot of talk from the podium about protests in Tunisia and Egypt. But Sir Martin tells the VIPs in his audience, quote, "Concentration of wealth, particularly in the United States, is a big issue." So relatively rich United States, not immune to this, he's warning, even as the Egyptian revolution is beginning to flare.
But the revolutions in the Arab world, including in Egypt, were about more than just income inequality, right? They were about corrupt regimes that were running the place and trying to change the power structure.
Absolutely. But it's built on a foundation, I think, of deep anger about an economic system that was seen as favoring the in crowd, the cronies, at the expense of everyone else. When I was in Cairo reporting on some of this for us, I was able to speak with Ahmed Maher, who's a civil engineer and one of the young leaders of the protests in Tahrir Square. He says it loud and clear.
And I have an Arab Rayat. The inequality in distributing the wealth has been the major, in my opinion, the major reason that pushed this revolution to be ripe.
So does it sound familiar? When the relatively few get much of the benefits of an economy, it can get people into the streets to make their displeasure known. But at the start of the year in our country, in the U.S., what do we have? Tea Party movement, mainly with a focus on lower taxes, but not necessarily this income inequality idea.
But, of course, by the end of the year, we have had an entire conversation changer with the rise of the Occupy Wall Street movement that's really changed the national discussion and brought a focus to income inequality.
Now, the Occupy Wall Street folks get criticized for not wanting to set a specific agenda, but it was interesting. The guy credited with coming up with the meme of the year. We are the 99%, the rallying cry for Occupy. His name is David Graeber, and he's an anthropologist.
Throughout human history, debts have been renegotiated. In fact, most of the most successful civilizations in human history always had some way of readjusting debts so that you don't end up in a situation where the big people end up effectively enslaving the little people.
Graeber went on to suggest this radical idea of what he called a debt jubilee, forgive us all our debts, as a way of restoring what he sees as justice to an economy marked by concentration of wealth at the top. That theme again.
But, David, as we head into the new year, the Occupy Wall Streeters have sort of dropped off the radar to a large degree as they've been kicked out of park after park across the country. Do you think the movement is on the decline?
No, it's cold out there in many time zones in the U.S. They're going to be back when it warms up. We have an election year begins in a couple of days. I'm hearing reports maybe that Occupy might have like a political convention sometime next year, one of these agenda-setting things. So they'll be back along with the Tea Party, although those two groups probably not occupying the same park.
Marketplace's David Brancaccio of our Economy 4.0 project. David, thanks so much and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Those protests that David just mentioned will take on another life in the pages of books. Historians and writers will offer their own spin on the rise of the people. But the question is, will we read those works on paper or screens or something else? For the next few days, we're going to hear from several people about what the future might look like. It's a commentary series we're calling What Now? Up first, here's Jennifer Ait Lee on books.
Bye-bye books. I don't mean the book as a dead tree object whose death has been predicted for decades. I mean the book as the primary unit of publishing, ideas of stories that come in 250 or more pages and sell for $5.99, $10.99, $24.99. And I really mean book as a term. Digital devices like Amazon Kindle and the Barnes & Noble Nook are changing what kinds of things get published. Why do they have to be as long as a whole book? Truth is, people like buying things for 99 cents and $1.99 for their digital devices. We know that from iTunes, we know that from the App Store, and now we know that from publishing. At any given point, if you look at the top 500 bestsellers on Amazon Kindle, about a third of them are $3 and below. That's what people want to pay. So we are seeing a new explosion of companies that are publishing shorter form things that are designed for lower prices. A lot of it is nonfiction, like supercharged magazine articles, that might not have warranted a whole book. We've all read books that shouldn't have been full books, like those books that have numbers in their titles. But the change does have something to cheer about. We can alter the way we tell stories. There are new ways to follow imaginary characters. In the same way television is different from movies, these new short stories could be different from traditional novels. It could be the return of the novella. The funny thing is, we don't even know what to call these things. Don't call them e-books, a horrible term which to me sounds like horseless carriage. First, because e-anything sounds pretty 1999, e-toys, eBay, e-harmony. And secondly, can it be called an e-book if it wasn't intended to be a book to begin with? You see everyone struggle with what to call these new units of writing. Amazon calls them Kindle singles, other companies call them shorts, Apple calls them quick reads. If you know what to call them, please give me a call.
Jennifer Ait Lee is a journalist and author of The Fortune Cookie Chronicles. You can send us your thoughts. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says contact. Coming up, if you plan on leaving a New Year's party three sheets to the wind, you might not want to walk home.
Walking drunk is one of the most dangerous activities you can engage in.
That story's coming up, but first, let's do the numbers. It seems most traders decided to extend their holiday, and the lack of movement on Wall Street reflected that. The Dow slipped 2 points to finish virtually flat at 12,291. The Nasdaq was able to tack on 6 points for a gain of 0.25%, closed at 26.25. The S&P 500 finished right back where it started at 1265. Just for the record, Bloomberg News reports the tiny gain for the S&P 500 so far this year, a return of just 0.6%, is the least it has budged in more than 40 years. An insurance industry trade group reported today that profitability plunged this year among U.S. property and casualty insurance providers. That sent Allstate shares down nearly 0.5% today. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The state funeral for North Korean leader Kim Jong-il is scheduled to begin. NASA holds a teleconference to preview twin spacecraft that should begin orbiting the moon this weekend. The probes will answer long-standing questions about the orb of night and hopefully finally put to rest the issue of whether or not it is made of cheese. And he portrayed Malcolm X on the big screen. Actor Denzel Washington turns 57. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Jeremy Hobson in for Kai Rizdal. So imagine you're driving through the suburbs of a big American city. You see an Applebee's on your right, Best Buy on your left, and then a big natural gas drilling operation. Turns out the new gas extraction technology known as hydraulic fracturing or fracking is actually making suburban drilling more possible. It is now easier and less expensive to extract natural gas from populated areas. From KUNC in Colorado, Kirk Sigler reports.
To get an idea of just how thirsty we're getting for oil and gas, a good place to start is the cul-de-sac where Shane Davis lives north of Denver.
Well, it's crazy. I mean, when you see these derricks that shoot up 150 feet in the air, they light up like a giant Christmas tree at nighttime.
From his back door, Davis looks out on a tan-colored drill rig and a pair of storage tanks less than 100 yards from his neighborhood of tract homes in the town of Firestone.
I see it as an eyesore, a big one.
In the past decade, Firestone has grown from 2,000 to more than 10,000 residents. And this year alone, the state has approved 16 drilling permits within the city limits.
It's not healthy.
His is not an uncommon complaint these days. For the past 2 years, the drill rigs have been on a steady march from the rural western slopes of the Rockies to eastern Colorado, where most of the people in this state live. All are looking for a piece of the Niobrara Shale, a vast underground rock formation thought to hold more than a billion barrels of oil. Just across the interstate, the city of Longmont is also starting to see a drilling boom.
I've seen that darn rig number 5 around here a lot lately.
Brad Skoll is the Longmont city planner. He stands next to a mobile rig that today is working a well surrounded by homes. Colorado state law is murky when it comes to drilling in populated areas. There's no law allowing cities and towns to ban fracking, but there's no provision that says they can't either. For now, Skoll says Longmont is trying to work with the state and the industry to regulate how and where drilling can occur within city limits.
It really becomes a matter of artful negotiation.
Nearby, the city of Colorado Springs has taken a different approach. It's enacted a 6-month ban on drilling. Cities and towns across the country, especially in the Northeast, are also trying to come to grips with the issue as fracking spreads to populated areas. John Nolan teaches land use law at Pace University in New York.
I mean, this is a high drama, if not melodrama, that we're dealing with. And I think it rivals pretty much any environmental and economic clash that we've had to work out in the past.
Some local governments in Colorado are embracing the economic side of that clash. Oil and gas is one of only a few sectors steadily adding jobs in the state. Weld County, northeast of Denver, now has more than 250,000 residents. It also has more producing wells than any other county in the country. Commissioner Sean Conway says oil and gas revenues now fund half of the county's budget.
It is going to provide, at a very challenging time for local and state governments, a new source of revenue that will allow them maybe to do some things that they couldn't do because of the economic challenges.
Still, even fracking advocates say drillers need to do more to educate and engage with landowners as rigs continue to go up in the suburbs. Tisha Schuler is the president of the Colorado Oil and Gas Association.
I think the reality is across the country where you have any kind of energy development right now, it's going to be happening in more developed areas.
Back in Firestone, Shane Davis takes a drive through his neighborhood. He says he wants more than just engagement.
You know, the irony, you know, we've got residential areas and yet we've got, you know, 25 signs that say danger or toxic chemicals.
Davis says his neighborhood was never meant to accommodate drilling. Colorado recently required energy companies to disclose the concentrations of chemicals used in fracking, but Davis wants even tighter regulations. As it stands, companies only need to maintain a setback of 150 feet when putting up rigs near homes. It's the minimum clearance needed to avoid damage in case the rig tips over. In Denver, I'm Kirk Sigler for Marketplace.
It's Freakonomics time. Every 2 weeks, we explore the hidden side of everything. And today, why the first decision you make in 2012 is riskier than you think. Here's Stephen Dubner.
Happy New Year, everybody. Now, how are you getting home from that party? If you're in New York City, where I live, good luck getting a taxi. And if you've had some champagne and you're even thinking about driving home, well, don't.
Drinking and driving is not only against the law, but it can also be deadly.
Over the limit, under arrest.
Friends, don't let friends drive drunk.
All right, so maybe you'll walk home. Smart move, right?
That's a terrible idea. Walking drunk is one of the most dangerous activities you can engage in.
That's Steve Levitt. He's my Freakonomics friend and co-author. He's also an economist at the University of Chicago.
Truly, if you're faced with exactly two choices, walking drunk or driving drunk, you absolutely should drive drunk.
Now, wait a minute. Levitt is not advocating that people drive drunk. We know how incredibly dangerous that is. But what about drunk walking? Is that dangerous? Consider a few numbers. In 2009, the most recent year for which we have data, about 34,000 people died in traffic accidents. Roughly half of them were drivers, 41% of whom were drunk. Now, there were about 4,000 pedestrians killed, and 35% of them were drunk. Here's Levitt again.
For every mile walked drunk, turns out to be 8 times more dangerous than the mile driven drunk. So just to put it simply, if you need to walk a mile from a party to your home, you're 8 times more likely to die doing that than if you jump behind the wheel and drive your car that same mile.
Now, there are some caveats here. A calculation like this requires some assumptions because there's no government database on drunk walking. Also, people drive drunk much farther distances than they'd walk drunk. And most important, a drunk walker can't hurt or kill someone else the way a drunk driver can. That said, the death toll from drunk walking is undeniable.
The danger of impaired walking is not insignificant. And certainly when it comes down to you, it's definitely significant.
Thomas Esposito is a trauma surgeon at Loyola University Health System in the Chicago area. He's used to seeing a New Year's Day spike in pedestrians who've been hit by cars. As a matter of fact, January 1st is the deadliest day of the year for pedestrians, and 58% of the people who died were drunk.
I'd rather work New Year's Eve than New Year's Day because a lot of the time on New Year's Day, that's when people start to realize someone's missing, where are they? And then they find them at the bottom of the stairs or on the side of the road injured.
Esposito also has personal experience with drunk walking. A few years ago, his cousin was hit by a car and killed while walking home from a New Year's party. He'd been drinking, thought it was better to leave his car and go home on foot.
Esposito believes we've done a pretty good job getting out the don't drink and drive message, but that we could do a lot better with don't drink and walk. Here's Steve Levitt again.
For 20 years, we've been told you should never, ever drive drunk. We should have been told you should never, ever walk drunk and you should never, ever drive drunk. And because nobody thought about it when we were coming up with what was moral and immoral, somehow now drunk walking just can't find its way into the immoral box.
So listen, have a great New Year's celebration, but if a friend has been drinking and starts reaching for the car keys or decides to set off on foot, don't let them. Because remember, friends don't let friends walk drunk. I'm Stephen Dubner for Marketplace.
For old time's sake and days gone by.
Stephen Dubner, our Freakonomics correspondent. He puts out a podcast, too. You can get that on iTunes and hear more at Freakonomics.com. He'll be back in 2 weeks.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, on the day that the Treasury Department told us the U.S. government is going to come within $100 billion of its debt limit this Friday. I won't explain the debt limit to you since we all got a crash course on it over the summer. This time, the White House is looking for a $1.2 trillion increase in the limit, and it appears getting that increase will be a lot easier than it was last time. For the record, the nation's borrowing limit would jump to $16.394 trillion. Your share of that? $52,402.28, give or take. And that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow shaved off 2 points, finishing at 12,291. The Nasdaq tacked on 6 points, or about a quarter of 1%, and the S&P 500 ended flat. Thanks to Justin Ho, Ethan Lindsay, and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Next time back on this show, the biggest trends in banking of 2011.
We've seen the ingeniousness of banks and how they structure derivatives, and now we're seeing it in how they slip fees past us.
Plus new regulations, the European debt crisis, and when are banks going to start lending again? I'm Jeremy Hobson. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.